Hi, Jim.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Fine, thanks. Happy inaugural day.
Happy inaugural day to you. Happy MLK Day as well.
Oh, right, right. Good point.
Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. And you, of course, are Jim Pinkerton, Fox News contributor, former advisor to Presidents Reagan and Bush 1, I believe. Is advisor stretching the truth? Well,
White House domestic policy advisor, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Back then in the Stone Age when IBM Selectrics walked the earth.
I remember it well. You know, speaking of that, in those days it took how long for conventional wisdom about an inaugural day address to coalesce?
Probably till the next morning's papers.
Right.
Whereas now Twitter has already declared this is like, we're speaking like 10 minutes after, maybe 15 minutes after the president's speech.
Right.
Speech was liberal. Not a memorable line, and everybody seems to hate the poet, who I'd never heard of until...
Who was that guy? I left the room and came back, and there was some guy talking poetically.
I confess I didn't watch it, because nowadays you can kind of pretend to be absorbing any news event through Twitter.
Yeah.
And maybe my Twitter feed is full of right-wing haters, but they were pretty much panning the poem.
Yeah, my sense was that his father worked in sugarcane fields or something. That was the little part I caught. Unless the poem was not meant to be truly self-referential.
Yeah, he's a Cuban. Actually, he's a Cuban refugee. His parents are Cuban refugees. A little fuzzy on that, but nonetheless, this is definitely heavy on Hispanics these days.
Not that that's a bad thing, right?
No, it's all kind of part of the new demographic order.
So your conservative friends on Twitter are saying it had no memorable lines, because one person whom you might have once considered a conservative friend on Twitter, whom you may no longer, David Frum, called attention to the line about these truths, though self-evident, are not self-executing or something.
Right.
He and a couple of other people thought that was a nice line. And you know, that in a way I think captures much of what the speech was about. It was... You might say, somebody on your side of the spectrum might say, it was a cynical attempt to base an activist agenda on bedrock values of the founders, such as basically freedom and equality, right? You might say that nothing much does follow from those in the way of an activist agenda, but he seemed to think so.
As a Hamiltonian myself, I don't disagree with the points that, you know, you can't fight enemies individually, and you need to do things like infrastructure, technology, and highways. I thought all that stuff was good. I don't particularly think that self-executing is a very good phrase. It's kind of bureaucratic and kind of, you know, option C on your list.
Algorithmic or
something. A better line from the president's point of view was, our journey has just begun. You know, that sort of, you know, rhythmic cadence stuff. I wouldn't be surprised. That would be, if I were writing the headline from the Obama team, I would use that. Our journey has just begun. It shows he's not sitting on his lead. He's not complacent about his second term. He's got hard work to do. I guess the line that jumped out at me most was that Seneca Falls, Selma Stonewall.
Mm-hmm.
Since we began by saying how quickly, you know, the conventionalism congeals thanks to mostly to Twitter, I mean, you know, with blogging heads, of course, playing a vital role in the further cementing of the conventionalism. Somebody's tweeted that was the first reference to gay in a presidential inaugural. It was certainly the first reference to Stonewall. I don't think I'd heard it, which, of course, was the famous anti-police riot in 1969, the sort of the scene as having kicked off the gay liberation movement. You know, it alliterated, and it was memorable, and it was concrete, and you always like speeches that have those assets.
And separate from that, there was an endorsement of gay marriage without quite using that phrase.
About the love and stuff. Yeah, there's that sort of love you take is equal to love you make. It sort of reminded me of that Beatles song, you know.
Did he put it quite like that?
No, they were nice homages, and I do mean this in a sincere way. The Tempered by a Hard Peace, which is from John F. Kennedy's inaugural in 1961, and then the, you know, Blood Drawn by the Sword will equal Blood Drawn by the Lash will equal to Blood Drawn by the Sword, which is Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural.
Okay, I wasn't sure of that.
Yeah.
I was wondering, you know, you hear in inaugural addresses, you often hear what you might call archaically eloquent language, right? I mean, language is clearly supposed to be eloquent, and it's not the way we talk today. And I guess sometimes, maybe often, it is an actual reference to an old text like that. I think sometimes they just make it up and want it to sound archaically eloquent, right? And what I wonder is, like, did they used to do that? So, like, did George Washington try to sound like people 200 years earlier? In other words, what we now consider archaically eloquent, was that just the way they talked then?
I know that, I mean, Lincoln was a big fan of Shakespeare, who was roughly three centuries before Lincoln, or 2.5 centuries. And so that's an interesting question. I mean, again, this is, fortunately, we're in a field where there's been, you know, centuries of hardcore scholarship on this. So I'm sure that exact question. I mean, Gary Wills wrote a book about how Shakespeare. I mean, he wrote the book about Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation and the Gettysburg Address. And I think that was heavy on Shakespeare references and stuff. So yeah, I do think that probably this your phrase archaically eloquent probably does require a couple. You have to look back a couple centuries, you know. So Shakespeare was looking to Chaucer, and you know, and Chaucer was looking to, you know, who knows?
Yeah, the Bible maybe.
English literature kind of fades out, you know.
Yeah. And becomes Germanic at some point.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I wonder generically, do these things really matter? I mean, people like you and me watch them and now tweet about them and before Twitter tried to be the first to say the smartest thing about them. I never personally paid a lot. I would not say I've watched nearly every one, except in cases like this when it is my duty to comment on it afterwards. I don't, you know, it just seems to me like, you know, they're going to get up, say America's great, and they're going to make it greater, and then wake me up when the rubber hits the road, you know, and stuff starts happening. But am I wrong? I mean, do these things really, really matter?
Well, I think it's sort of, you know, what, Kant would call the noumena and the phenomena. I mean, the noumena is the speech itself, which is America's great and so on. You know, and the phenomenon is sort of what happens afterwards and what's associated with it. I mean, for example, John F. Kennedy's speech in 1961, that Barony Burden, you know, fight any foe, was clearly kind of a prelude to Vietnam kind of the Green Berets and all this. You know, who knows if Kennedy was killed in 1963, and who knows what he would have done. You know, Lyndon Johnson did, although there's plenty of reason to think he would have done the exact same thing in terms of a major escalation the way Johnson did it in the later 60s. FDR's second inaugural, I mean, I just think back to David Moranis had a piece in the Washington Post a day or two ago that said that the president's two inspirations for this inaugural, President Obama, that is, were FDR in 37 and Eisenhower in 53, his first inaugural. And the point being about Roosevelt was, you know, we were consolidating our gains after a bad economy, and Eisenhower on infrastructure and I guess even more important than that, getting out of foreign wars. And so if Obama says we're ending a decade of war, and the decade, which he did say in the speech today, and we do.
Although someone pointed out on Twitter, there was a drone strike in Yemen today. But anyway, go ahead.
Right, exactly. And so, meanwhile, if on the other hand, if he follows through, and you know, the war on terror consists of drone strikes that nobody really in America pays much attention to, that's one thing. And on the other hand, if we get sucked into Mali or Algeria or Yemen or Iran or whatever it might be, then the speech will be seen as, gee, what a false and hypocritical speech he made on that. I mean, by at least some critics and so on. So I guess, again, the words themselves tend to be kind of, although, again, there's some of them. Roosevelt's speech, you know, I see it in One Third of a Nation in Poverty. I mean, you know, it was. Some speeches, I guess, do have genuine. I mean, Reagan's in the current crisis, government is not the solution, government is the problem, which is usually just truncated to be government is the problem, which is not what Reagan said in 81. Again, it's what the president makes of it after the fact that vindicates the speech.
And I think it's what determines whether the speech will be long remembered.
Right.
I mean, you know. had Roosevelt not been given credit for pulling us out of the Great Depression, and had not many books been written about that, the line you quoted might not be so resonant. Had Kennedy not been assassinated, I think parts of his speech might not be so well remembered. And you're right. Had we not gotten into Vietnam, the particular part you mentioned might have been lost in the mists of history. Speaking of that, though, the one thing Obama did say was that we will support democracy abroad. Well, there was some line about we will act on behalf of those who long for freedom. That's pretty vague. You know, it doesn't say we'll intervene. It's a matter of interpretation, but there are people who would like it to mean we'll intervene when necessary, and right. I think they'll probably be disappointed. But
well, we'll see. I mean, there were a couple of Bush 43-ish lines in there about how our freedom is connected to everybody else's freedom, which is kind of in a softer way. It's a softer version of what Bush 43 said in 2005 in an inaugural address that was widely seen as a little over the top about the untamed fire of democracy and so on. But yeah, I mean, Obama has some of those instincts, and we are in this situation where we've got worldwide commitments, and Obama has been seen as kind of a realist, and I guess he's. I mean, there's another point there. What's the rhetorical term for saying things that you don't really necessarily believe, but you think you have to say to defend yourself? So, if you're trying, for example, to push Chuck Hagel through the Senate confirmation to be defense secretary, you might have to sound a little more Wilsonian than you really mean, just to sort of give Hagel some cover.
I hadn't made that connection. I mean, Hagel is going to be saying plenty of stuff he might not have otherwise said in the next 10 days, but I don't know. And he's already said some of it to Chuck Schumer. But I don't know about Obama. I should slightly amend my earlier characterization. When I said one might depict this as an attempt to place an activist agenda on kind of the foundation of basic values like freedom and equality before the law and before the eyes of God, I don't really mean he sketched out an activist agenda in great detail. He did talk about climate change. He made a reference to gay marriage. But it wasn't State of the Union-y. And I think the main message was a little more generic, which is that, you cannot realize these bedrock values without collective action. Right. He used that phrase.
I think he hit it heavier than he had to, if that was all he wanted to get across. I think he was getting across, social solidarity, education. We all need a chance. The defending Social Security and Medicare. And I think he said Medicaid as well. I mean, that's cheering to AARP and to Nancy Pelosi and to the left and so on. I thought he gave a solidaristic communitarian speech, right. Much more than he had to.
Okay. So what are you, leaving the speech aside, what are you seeing in the next 4 years? I'll leave it at that. What are you seeing in the next 4 years?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic. I think he'll have a hard time with a lot of elements of his domestic agenda. I guess he referred to gun control in the Newtown, Connecticut reference. I guess that was the only reference that I can remember. You read bleak things about what the Democratic Senate will do on this. Senator Barrasso, who's a Republican, said he thought that Senator Reid, who's of course the Democratic leader, wasn't even going to bring gun control to the Senate. Assault weapons, that is. That's a pretty big grinding of the gears on that. I'm not really aware that climate change is any more popular, today than as a concern, is a really more popular than it was 2 or 3 years ago, or almost, what was it, 2009, when President Obama pushed it the first time around.
It may have gotten a little mileage out of Hurricane Sandy. At least Michael Bloomberg tried to.
I think I wrote a piece for the British Spectator in November. Making the point that we're to borrow the famous trope from Isaac Asimov, we've got an irresistible force and an immovable object colliding with each other. Well, the irresistible force is the desire for more energy, and for that matter, cheap energy. and the immovable object is concerns about global warming and CO2 and so on. And it seems to me that the only way out that will enable full auto fracking and shale oil and everything else is some satisfactory plan on carbon sequestration. And by that I don't mean, do not mean, burying CO2 in the ground. I think that is just so counterintuitive and so scary to people on the burp dimension that you're just never going to
What's the burp dimension?
Oh, just things blowing up.
Oh.
And there are, in fact, natural formations of CO2 completely independent of mankind that, in fact, do blow up every so often. They sort of spontaneously explode.
Blowing up is something people don't like. You're right.
Right, and it's just creepy to think, though, gee whiz, thank you for letting us borrow your farmland here, and we're now going to put 100 million tons of CO2, and we promise it won't blow up on you when you're sitting there watching TV. Right. As I Googled around on this and clicked around on it, I ran across a company in upstate New York called Novomer, which actually got a grant from the Energy Department in 2010, the Obama Energy Department, which turned liquid CO2, which is sort of industrial CO2, into plastic, which I thought was pretty cool. And I thought, well, gee, if plants can turn CO2 into plants and trees and so on,
why can't plastic turn it into plastic?
Back in the Bush 41 days, when the climate change issue first came up, I thought, and they said, look, there's lots of ways to deal with CO2, one of which is carbon sinks, which is trees. I've had this idea in my head for a long time, and others, like this Novomer people, have been actually doing it. And I think that if the president wants to achieve his goals on CO2 reduction, or for that matter, if Exxon wants to achieve its goals on energy production, they had better find some technological fix on this that satisfies both sides. It won't make the hardcore Greens and Greenpeace and Sierra Club happy. They'll hate it anyway, and it'll add cost to the value of energy, which will make some people unhappy, but it will enable, North Dakota just achieve its destiny as the Saudi Arabia of North America. And for that matter, places like California, I just read somewhere in the journal just a couple days ago that the state waters of California, just between, 0 and 3 miles offshore of California, has $1 trillion worth of oil. Mm-hmm. And you can drill it now from the land. You don't have to go out to offshore oil drills anymore that might spill. You can drill it from the land and then put the drill sideways and go under the land, under the beach and into the water to drill the oil out of there. That's a pretty good deal for a state like California that's having so many budget problems.
Okay, so assuming Obama doesn't do exactly what you would prescribe, which I believe has happened before, what action on climate change do you think his references to it in the inaugural address do portend? What do you expect?
I think the idea of cap and trade is so impossible to explain and understand and difficult and seems so Fannie Mae-ish or Wall Street-ish, in terms of its manipulations.
Well, and it's beloved by economists too, which is further grounds for suspicion.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I suppose they may try and haul out cap and trade again. They could try a carbon tax, which I think would be a complete political non-starter. Mm-hmm. Or they could simply do what the EPA is doing now, which is sort of shut down every coal plant they can come across. That's probably what they'll settle on. Mm-hmm. They'll tell themselves that, natural gas is cleaner than coal, so we'll continue to shut down coal plants as we can opportunistically through the EPA. And we'll run on natural gas, which is at least cleaner. And then in some future Democratic administration or later in the Obama term, they'll figure out how to go after natural gas. Although they still have the problem of, what they're going to replace it all with. And batteries, with a 787 Dreamliner having problems with batteries. I mean, batteries aren't quite the techno fix that people thought they were. Mm-hmm. If they could leak in the middle of your airplane flight, that doesn't bode well for all the other uses that lithium-ion batteries could be having.
Yes, I've got some pretty leak-proof batteries, but so what else? So climate change. I mean, what are the big items you would have thought about on his agenda, even if he hadn't given this speech? I mean, there's the economy, right? And my guess on the economy is, barring something bad happening beyond his control, like, say, the Eurozone going into a complete, earthquake-level crisis, some sort of, or like, major recession in China or something, that we will slowly, work our way back. You know, the things will get slowly better, and, like, will be not that bad at the end of his term, although I'm talking about the aggregate economic performance. I think income inequality is not a problem that will solve itself. But anyway, what do you think will happen?
Well, I should mention one area where I think there's constructive compromise in the making is a corporate tax reform. I'm actually a part of a group called the Rate Coalition, Reforming America's Taxes Equitably, which is trying to get the top corporate rate down from 35 down to 25, which is the average of the OECD countries. And in return for that, our Rate Coalition members are willing to put all tax expenditures on the table to achieve a 1986-like tax reform. And
so wait, specifically, what kind of thing would you be willing to give in exchange for that?
Anything that falls in the category of tax expenditures, which is a long list.
So you mean cutting deductions, cutting loopholes.
Right. It's like the 86 tax reform. And interestingly enough, the president has mentioned it in his past States of the Union addresses as an idea. He mentioned that we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world, in the industrialized world, as of April 1st of 2012. Senator Portman of Ohio, Republican, had a big article in Politico saying this is a top priority just a couple days ago. And Valerie Jarrett in the White House in the article in Politico on Friday said pretty much the same thing. So again, this is something I'm working on. So I'm obviously following it closely, and some would say I do have an interest in it. But you asked, and it is one area of potential compromise where significant chunks of the Obama administration, or for that matter, including the president, and many Democrats in Congress and many Republicans see as a fruitful compromise. There are other areas of, shall we say, more discord, but that's one area of compromise. And the fact is, it was since 2000 that the U.S. share of the top 500 corporations in the world domiciled in the United States has fallen by a third. Mm-hmm. We've lost ground as companies, including, for example, the Eaton Corporation of Cleveland, moved to Ireland. Ireland has a 12.5% rate. Do the math. A lot of countries, Canada has a much lower rate than we do. The federal rate is 15%. And we're at 35%.
Well, but the logic of that is a race to the bottom where, in the end, corporations aren't taxed at all, which I guess would be okay with you.
The logic is we're in a competitive world. And if Ireland has a 12.5% rate and the UK has a 23% rate, what does that tell you about where companies
are? How come Ireland's doing worse than us?
They are in many ways, but they're doing well on attracting corporate headquarters, that's for sure.
Of course, corporate headquarters don't necessarily employ a lot of people in the immediate vicinity.
They are good jobs and good wages.
Yeah, for the CEOs who are in the headquarters.
If the CEO pays himself whatever, how many people in the area does that hire? I mean, it's a competitive. It's surely what we've seen in the last 30 years has been a worldwide lowering of tax rates. The OECD corporate tax average in 1985 was about 50, and now it's 25. Now, does that tell you anything about where the world's headed? It probably does. The tax rate on Japan, China has gone from, 100% under communism or 101% under communism to, much lower right now. We do have this problem of mobile capital, and we do, this is
all right.
This
I understand. Not, I understand the problem. I'm just saying, the logic of it is a race to the bottom. There are alternatives, maybe we should get the UN to impose a global corporate tax. How do you feel about that, Jim?
Oh, no problem with that. and the world will love it. Look, we're having a little illustration in tax rate policy with France, right? To the French, Hollande, the new president comes in with a 75% tax rate, and immediately everybody who could pay that leaves. Is that, does that make for wise tax policy for France? Probably not. What other people call competition for capital and jobs.
I say any policy that gets Gerard Depardieu to leave your country is a good policy.
Well, he paid €145 million. According to his calculations, he paid €145 million in taxes, which is about $200 million.
I don't think he really left either. I don't think he actually left. I think he just bought a condo in Moscow or something.
Well, no, he moved his actual residence at first to Belgium.
Belgium.
He moved one half mile
mm-hmm.
into the country of Belgium from France. And maybe since then, I saw that he's gotten this Russian passport as well. I'm not sure how these rules work, whether you can have a Belgian passport and a Russian passport. The projections are, as you say, mm-hmm. or even with or without corporate tax reform, for slow growth. And so we got to figure out, do the Democrats, for example, really want to go into the 2014 midterms with unemployment still above 7%? I saw a projection that the unemployment rate would end 2013 at 7.4, which is pretty darn high by historical averages. And so,
we'll see. I do believe, I think it'll be lower than that by the end of his tenure, but I do think it's not the only thing that matters. I do think income inequality matters. And although corporate tax may not be the most efficient path through which to address income inequality, the tax system in principle is one avenue. And income inequality is a relative problem. If you tax rich people more heavily and they have less money, you have less income inequality. You know.
Well, it's not really clear that just if you say it that way, that the poor or the middle class will get the money in return.
No, but I'm saying it's a relative problem. Even if they don't, there's still less income inequality. And if income inequality is some kind of corrosive psychological effect, then actually that's something. But it's also true that you can actually use it to improve health care for poor people and so on.
Right, but if the net wealth of the country decreases, then you can have greater income equality in a poorer country.
Yeah.
I don't think the American people would vote for that.
Less income.
I don't think the way they see the
you
world.
Mean less income inequality in a poorer country. And if you ask me, is there some point, some extreme of income inequality where I would rather the country be a little poorer if it could have appreciably less income inequality? The answer is, for me, yes, there is such a thing. I can imagine such a thing. I'm not sure we're there yet.
If somebody ran on the Bob Wright platform of less income inequality in a poorer country, and somebody else ran on the platform of greater income inequality but a richer country, I think the latter would win.
That's actually not what I call my platform. I call my platform soak the rich and give it to the 99%. That's what I call my platform. The fact that it might lower aggregate output is between you and me, okay?
I note that you're now, and you're certainly entitled to, you're putting yourself well to the left of what the president said in his speech today.
That's not hard. He didn't get into this, really.
No, he didn't. You're right. He didn't. He did talk, as I mentioned, a lot about solidarity and so on. Mm-hmm. So I think he did talk a lot about, it's unclear. He didn't, for example, attack the carried interest provision at all. I didn't hear any mention of that. It's just, again, back to France, back to the challenges of which the European Union faces with Ireland and Cyprus and these other countries with low corporate taxes and so on, and low taxes in general. I mean, tax harmonization is a major effort being pushed by the European Union, and they want to include the U.S. and so on, and it may be a good idea.
But I don't think you would want us to harmonize with all aspects of their tax structure, just the parts you like. You want full-fledged harmony with the European approach to taxation? I might be happy about that, but you don't want it.
But then again, you've put yourself on the table as sort of left of the president on these things. What the American people want to hear about. That's why I think the fracking thing is so important. I think the chance to add many zeros to U.S. GDP on energy production.
Raising taxes on the American people works totally. It just happened. politically, and the Republicans were just dumbfounded to discover that actually there's quite a bit. It works politically to say, I want to raise taxes on rich people. We just saw that. We could see more of it.
We could, and Chuck Schumer said so on the shows yesterday. We'll see what it does to the economy.
Okay, but on that point, look, we have a big budget deficit, and that is a big variable that's going to come into play here. Most people think it should be reduced. Some people think you can reduce it significantly entirely through spending. You may be one such, but a whole lot of people think you're going to need to increase revenue one way or another. Now, it's true that there are some ways to increase revenue without reducing the efficiency of the economy. There are some really, really bad loopholes. I don't think there are as many as people think. So beyond some point, you got to raise taxes on somebody. And it's certainly not clear to me that the incentive effects on raising the taxes on rich people are any more destructive than the incentives effects you have by raising them on the middle class or poor people. There's that argument that, look, we got to raise some taxes. Why not do it on people who already have more money?
It's not obvious to me we should be raising taxes on anybody.
Okay,
you don't
agree with my premise. A lot of people do buy the premise, though.
They do. But I think, look, interest rates are in negative territory right now. Something's going on. We are in some kind of liquidity trap in this country and worldwide.
So
more important for the country's prosperity is, and again, the president touched on some of this, investment in technology and investment in infrastructure. Those are much more vital to whether the economy grows. Look, the Bush 43 Center, and as you know, I'm not the world's biggest Bush 43 fan, but the Bush 43 Center in Dallas has a project that they call the 4% Project, which points out that if growth would go back to 4% or go up to 4% from its current 2, then we'd balance the budget in 10 or 15 years. They've got a bunch of ideas how to do this that you might not agree with, or I mean, maybe I wouldn't necessarily agree with all of them. But it's clear that the math, we're not going to be able to cut our way out of this deficit, and we're not going to be able to tax our way out of this deficit. In the end, we're going to have to grow our way.
So you are not a short-term deficit hawk. You don't even buy the premise, fairly widely accepted premise of much of the politics of the next 4 years in that sense.
I think growth is more important.
Okay.
I think that you can have any deal you want, any budget deal you want on we're going to restrict the Medicare spending in 2035 or 2025 or whenever it is, and it's not terribly valuable in the face of looming demographic economic challenges, like, for example, Alzheimer's. If Alzheimer's is a $200 billion a year hit on the economy, headed towards $1 trillion a year, then nobody's healthcare plan, nobody's, Paul Ryan, Peter Orszag, nobody's healthcare plan is going to adjust that very much. Healthcare is expensive because the population is aging and people are getting sick. So you can't handshake your way out of that. You're going to have to fix it somehow by, for example, curing Alzheimer's, which is a much more important social goal anyway than allegedly balancing the budget in 2040.
With every passing year, I am more in favor of curing Alzheimer's. So so we've got the economy. I mean, wouldn't you say that 4 years from now, when people start sizing up the legacy, it's going to have a lot to do? I mean, he'll try to do something on gun control. I think he'll wind up doing not a whole lot. He'll try to do something on climate change, probably not a whole lot. In the end, don't you think legacy is largely going to be about the economy and at least the unknown parts of his legacy?
Bob?
Yeah.
Can you hear this?
A little.
We had water come into the mechanical realm, which is a pump room for...
I can't turn this off. You want to stop for a second?
No, I think it's great TV. What's the guy saying? It sounds like an emergency or something.
It's the water went out of the building.
That's great. That's great. Do you think there's a chance we'll get like a shot of you drowning or anything?
I think I'm safe. Thank you. But
Okay.
We can keep talking.
Well, we should actually...
This is live television almost.
This is what we live for, blogging heads.
Okay.
On-screen fatalities. So
this is Captain Smith is saying there's plenty of lifeboats, nothing to worry about. And
well, you would let women and children go first anyway. No, I know you.
I would. Confident that we're all going to be safe.
Yeah. Okay, then we'll make this the wrap-up question. It's like any other. Now that's a nice shot, Jim. Whatever you do, Don't move your head. Oh, you moved it. The wrap up question. Okay, we've talked about the economy. I guess my belief is, in terms of the unknown parts of Barack Obama's legacy, we're talking mainly what's the economy going to be like, mainly in the aggregate, but with a dimension of income inequality thrown in, and then like foreign policy. If the apocalypse happens, that's bad. If things get worse, that's bad. If people feel more threatened by terrorism or whatever, that's bad. Certainly if some kind of 9/11 happens, that's terrible. But what would you say about that? Are those not the main two dimensions of the unknown part of his legacy, economics and kind of, you know, national security?
Yeah, I think that the policy of the last 10 years will not be the policy of the next 10 years. I think I said at the time that I think we were sort of hitting a kind of a Suez moment during the Iraq War. We're just not going to be able to do this anymore as a nation. And, I think that you're seeing a better counterterrorism plan in Algeria and Mali, where allies do it, not us. There's much to be said for fighting terrorism and killing Al-Qaeda and so on, and drone strikes and so on. Between drones, which are not labor-intensive, shall we say, the way liberating people in the 82nd Airborne is, and between using allies and auxiliaries like the French or the Malians or the African Union, that's a much smarter way to do it. And if the U.S. can coordinate that, then I think there's a reasonable chance for, or a pretty good chance for success. Although obviously we have, a handful on our hands in the minutes anyway. But what's pretty clear, and I think you and I, Bob, have always agreed on this, is the presence of American troops as liberators and nation builders does not work out well in the modern context.
No, I mean, and I'm a little more skeptical of drone strikes than you are, because I think they come with the American brand on them. I mean, one of the problems with having the troops there is it leads people to hate Americans, and that helps terrorist recruiters. And I think drone strikes have some of those properties, but I certainly agree, outsource as much of this stuff as possible. I don't know yet whether the French intervention will turn out to have been a good idea, but certainly from a standpoint of American national security, better them than us.
Well, and also, we do have alliances, and this is something that we do need to, and I think the president said nice things about alliances and the value of working together and stuff. The French are, even if they have a bad tax system, the French are our ally, and if they think it's vital that we do this, we should help them. That's what NATO is all about, and I think NATO is the single best, sort of political resource we have in terms of international affairs, and the Algerians certainly seem to have a tough attitude towards terror, right? They don't seem to kid around. And that's valuable as well. This whole thing could have been much different if there had been some protracted hostage crisis trying to negotiate with them and so on. That would have been very unpleasant. Still probably would have worked out badly. You need tough-minded people who see Zero Dark 30 to get pointers, not to get instructed on what not to do. And I think the Algerians fit into that category.
I do not agree with all of that, but I would say that the thing I most like about our seeming determination not to get involved with troops in Mali or probably in Syria is just that it represents a rethinking of the previously almost reflexive idea that the function of the U.S. is to solve all the world's problems. And right. I think, problems should be addressed as locally or regionally as possible. I suppose in that sense, I'm a conservative. And I think the ideal in Mali is what the French are now hoping will happen, is that they'll just stay there long enough for African troops, including regional forces, to stand up and do what work needs to be done.
Now, that strikes me as kind of unpromising, and I've always been a fan of partition. If you look at a map of Mali, there's an ethnic map somewhere.
Yeah.
I found it online, and the northern half is clearly Tuareg and Muslim, and the southern half, or whatever percentage, is clearly African, I think, and Christian, I think.
No. I think it's mainly Muslim there, too.
Okay, mainly Muslim, fair enough, but it's
definitely... But the Tuaregs are ethnically different. They are Berbers.
Or sub-Saharan Africa.
Right.
It's probably never going to be a happy country, and it probably will be some long-term, de facto, you know, partition there. And so, but I will say this, the world that we're both sort of painting here, I mean, I think, again, is a world where, for example, the Chinese, you know, who are not in this category of Muslim terror at all, are going to be free and encouraged and likely to, not encouraged by us, but encouraged by themselves to develop long-range missiles and, you know, and cyber warfare and so on. I do think that the burden on America to have a technologically proficient military, including missile defense and including whatever heavy-duty anti-Stuxnet type things we need, is very important. And I think that it's naive to think you're going to have a non-nuclear world anytime soon. I think it's important that we have, again, missile defense comes to mind immediately, plus whatever else is needed. I think these are this is a shift in the military. Labor-intensive occupation and liberation and counterinsurgency to technology-intensive high defense. I think that's what's needed. And I'm not really sure if the president has thought in the term.
Okay, you broke up a little there, but I think what you...
Matter of fact, maybe not at all. Maybe just the opposite.
You broke up a little there, but I think you said you're not sure that the president has thought this through the way you would like him to. I think I will resist...
Right.
I think I will resist... starting a debate on this particular subject because, but I could. We should have a whole nother conversation on this.
He knows that it's making his teeth, and so I understand that. Yeah, but we can continue this later.
Let's do all because you are, for one thing, you are starting to break up, and also you are increasingly saying things that are wrong. So for both of those reasons, Jim, we really.
We're being thrown off.
We really have to stop this. You're being thrown off the island. But thanks a million, and let's do it again, Jim.
All right, thank you, Bob. Have a good day.
Okay, bye. Okay.